Actress Carrie Preston, who got her acting legs on stage at Shanklin Theater, is starring in the second season of Elsbeth on CBS. I'm David James, and next on 2 Main Street, my conversation with the University of Evansville graduate who says she was promised that if she went to U of E, she would be admitted to the Juilliard School of Acting. And she was right. Carrie will share those early plays at U of E, the chemistry with her current co-stars, and the beloved character she has played for over a decade, Elsbeth. We'll also chat with Evansville native Matt Williams, another U of E theater grad, about his new book, Glimpses. 2 Main Street is next, presented by Jeffrey Berger Kimrin and the Berger Wealth Team at Bayard Private Wealth Management. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Got my Aces shirt on here.
Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah, I'm a U of E grad, and my wife is too, and my daughter is too.
Oh my gosh, it's a whole family affair.
Family of Aces, definitely. Ready to do this?
Yeah, sounds great. Thank
All right, you. Let's do it. 3, 2, 1. From the WNIN Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. My guest is actress Carrie Preston, a graduate of the University of Evansville, just one of the many U of E theater alums who have excelled in the showbiz as actors, directors, writers, and producers. And later, I'll be talking to Matt Williams, creator of the hit TV shows Roseanne and Home Improvement, about his new book, Glimpses. Now, before her long career on stage, film, and television, Carrie auditioned for roles at U of E's Shanklin Theater, and I'm sure she remembers opening night of Spring Awakening in the role of Wendla. Well, today, Carrie Preston is best known for her character Arlene Fowler in the HBO series True Blood, also for her role as Elsbeth Tasconi, the eccentric trial lawyer in the CBS series The Good Wife and a spinoff The Good Fight, receiving a Primetime Emmy Award. Carrie Preston is now starring in the second season of the comedy crime drama Elsbeth, also on CBS. So, Carrie, welcome to 2 Main Street and congrats on this second season.
Thank you so much. This role has been such a gift. I started playing Elsbeth. It's actually Tassioni. We do have a running joke. Many characters come on the show and don't know how to pronounce her last name. So you are in good company there. Okay. And we make a whole bit of it, actually, which is hilarious. Some people, you know, call it like Elsbeth Tortiglione, Tascione, Tacchione. It's sort of our running joke. But that she's a very singular character. So the fact that she has a name that is not only the first name that's hard to pronounce, the second name is hard to pronounce, it makes her all the more unique. But I started playing her 14 years ago on The Good Wife, and then you know, thinking it was just a guest spot. And then a couple of seasons later, they, you know, said, well, why don't you come back and play her again? And they just started writing more and more for me. And I ended up recurring on that show and recurring on The Good Fight. And then they thought, well, let's put her at the center of her own show. So the fact that they let me do that for a role that I only played periodically, and then not only that, that it did well enough and caught on enough with audiences to be picked up for a second season is just more than a dream come true.
Well, I'm certainly a fan of the show as well. Let's do some time travel back to your days on the University of Evansville campus. 1989, opening night of Spring Awakening, a dark German tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that night?
Yes. you know, this is a play that, you know, in its day, I think it was written in like maybe 1891. It was, you know, banned. I mean, it was dealing with a lot of really intense issues for any play, even today. But back then it was dealing with, you know, teenage suicide. It was dealing with home abortions. It was dealing with a sexual awakening at a maybe inappropriately young age. So it was it had a lot of history behind it. And John David Lutz, our beloved John David Lutz, was you know, interested in creating a production of that, and I was new to the university, and was thrilled to be cast in this role. And we needed to handle all those subject matters in a delicate and responsible way. And of course, Lutz, that is something that he did brilliantly. And then we ended up getting to take that production to the Kennedy Center. Wow. as a part of the American Theater College Theater Festival. And we were selected in the region to represent the region. And so I got to, not only did I get to do that in Evansville, I also got to perform at the Kennedy Center, which, you know, I have yet to do since. So, you know, that was a big honor and a big thrill.
Well, that's a great memory there. Now,
yeah.
Thanks to the U of E Theater Department, Carrie, we have more of your playbill, Hermia in Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream. Fortunately, this was a comedy.
Yes, this was quite different than Spring Awakening, it was such a fun romp. You know, that play is such a crowd pleaser. Mm-hmm. I've gone on to do several different roles in that play. It's just one of those that, you know, audiences love, and, you know, you play, you kind of, if you're lucky, you can play one of the lovers like I did. And then when I was at Juilliard, I got to play Titania in that show as well. So, you know, Shakespeare is kind of my first love, you know. Mm-hmm. I started doing it at a young age, got to work in all of the great Shakespeare festivals across the country, and, you know, went to Juilliard, which is a classical theater training program out of Evansville. I would not have gotten into Juilliard had I not gone to Evansville. That is for certain. That university sets us up for success, as you can attest to with the amount of people that have come out of that program that are doing so well in this, you know, quite challenging industry.
Now, also, Roots in a Parched Ground, the role of Inez, The Shadow Box, the role of Felicity, and Three Sisters, Irina, any favorites mm-hmm. there?
Well, Three Sisters holds a special place in my heart. It was, I believe, John David's favorite show that he directed with my era. You know, he was there for so long. He started that theater program, and so he had, you know, eras of students that he would go through and inspire. And that production, just, you know, even up until his passing, he would talk about that production as being something that was super special for him, and it was certainly for us. I mean, I'm still good friends with people that are, you know, were in that with me. Mm-hmm. And so that one, I think, really holds a special place for me.
Now, Carrie, you grew up in Macon, Georgia. So how did you end up at the University of Evansville?
Well, I started off going to college at the College of Charleston in South Carolina. And a professor there, the acting teacher there, and one of our directors there, R. Scott Lank, ended up talking me into auditioning for Evansville because he was an alum, and then he went on to teach at the University of Evansville. But he said, "You've got to check this school out." And I said, "Oh, no, I want to go to Juilliard." And he's like, "Okay, you can audition for Juilliard, but I'd like for you to look at this school too, because I think it would be a good fit." And so I did audition for Juilliard back then, didn't get in. And then Lutz, John David, said to me, "If you come to Evansville, I will get you into Juilliard," which was quite a statement to make because they only let in at that time about 7 women a year. So, you know, the fact that I was able to go there, get the education that I needed from that school and the audition skills that I needed to get into Juilliard. When I did, John David called me up. I called him to tell him I got him to Juilliard, and he was like, phew, I'm never going to promise that to another student again. But he was very relieved that, but that's how well that school set me up for success.
That's a great story. Now let's talk about your second season of Elsbeth, the character created by writers Michelle and Robert King. Tell me about them.
Well, you know, they're brilliant. They, you know, they created and ran The Good Wife, The Good Fight, Evil, Brain Dead. They have, you know, other shows that they produce, Your Honor, this the upcoming Happy Face. So they're kind of an empire, you know, right. The two of them. And they're also just extremely talented, incredibly lovely people. Mm-hmm. And they're very loyal. And so they, you know, find actors and directors that they love to work with, and then they bring them into their fold. So I am lucky enough to be one of those people. You know, this character came out of their brilliant minds, like I said, 14 years ago. And the fact that they just kept wanting to revisit her and mm-hmm. expand her. And then they took her out of the legal world and then plopped her right down into the middle of a police procedural, which speaks a lot to their talent. But then Jonathan Tolens they passed the baton to him, and he's our showrunner. So he's now in charge. You know, they did the pilot, but he's in charge of our show, and he has assembled an incredible stable of writers, he himself being the leader, and they're creating these really wonderful scripts that are kind of a throwback, you know, to mm-hmm. an earlier structure like Columbo, where, you know, you see the murder at the beginning of the episode, so you know who the killer is, and then you just see this unexpected, unorthodox character come in and put all the pieces together and bring the killer to justice. And so I think it's a satisfying structure. I think that we're bringing a fresh take to it. And season two, we're just, you know, delving more into it now that we've got our sea legs.
Well, this character certainly has legs over all these years. Now, season two, you feature actor Nathan Lane. What was it like to work with Nathan?
Well, you know, he's so beloved and respected in the industry. I had worked with him briefly, actually, already as Elsbeth Fascioni when he came on and did it. We both did an episode guest starring on The Good Wife. So I had worked with him, I don't know, 10 years ago. But he's so brilliant, you know, and he came into this experience and it was as if he had been a part of our show the whole time. I mean, he just had that level of attack on the role that was so seasoned. I swear I never saw him even look at the script. It was already in his bones. And you know, you don't have that much time with a script in episodic television, but that's the level of skill that he has. So it was like, you know, playing in a classical symphony with him, you know, and the joy of it was that the episode is about opera. So he's playing this opera lover. So, you know, dare I say, the episode is pretty operatic.
I bet. Now, you have a great cast, of course, on your show. The long-suffering New York City police captain, Wagner, played by Wendell Pierce. What a great actor.
He's brilliant. And boy, is he such a love. I mean, he is such a kind, generous person. He loves the show. He loves to be there. He's got so many other things that go on in his life, but when he comes to set, he really does kind of bring this sense of wonder and joy, which is something that I like to bring mm-hmm. to the show as well. So we have a great chemistry.
Officer, is it Blanky, played by Kara Blanc. Patterson?
Blanc,
mm-hmm. played by mm-hmm. Kara Patterson. Tell me about her.
Kara is amazing too. She's a lovely, kind soul, you know. She's just someone who her energy and her energy as Kaya Blanc and my energy as Elsbeth are so different, yet somehow it works together, and it and you come up with a unique relationship on screen that maybe we haven't fully seen before. And so I feel really proud of what we've done to flesh out our friendship on screen and off.
Now, your husband, Michael Emerson, also an actor, his reaction to your role?
You know, he's so, you know, we've been together for 30 years and he's so supportive of me and I of him. I mean, I just, you know, think he's one of the best actors that is working right now. And the fact that, you know, I get to be married to him is always something that I, you know, I never take for granted. And I just love him so much. And he, one day after the first season had been fully airing, I mean, we'd had several episodes already airing. I remember I was, you know, at another part of the house and I heard my voice coming from the living room. And I came in he was sitting there watching the show. And I was like, "What are you doing?" And he's like, "I just wanted to rewatch the episodes because I feel like I needed to see, you know, really appreciate the nuances of what you're doing." And it was just the sweetest thing that he was just in there on his own rewatching my work. And that just speaks to how supportive he is.
Do you see Michael appearing on the show someday?
Well, I hope so. You'll have to tune in and see.
Okay.
You know, we would be so lucky to get him. So.
Now, your brother, John, also an actor?
My brother is an actor as well. He does a lot of theater, and we've worked together over the years in various places. And actually, I met Michael at the Alabama Shakespeare Festival, where I had gone to do a production of Hamlet so that I could work with my brother, who was also in the production, not knowing that I was going to be meeting my future husband. So yeah, my brother is a really brilliant actor, and he makes me laugh more than anybody else on the planet.
So did you come from a showbiz family?
No, we didn't. Although my mother is a visual artist. So she, you know, gave and instilled in us a real appreciation of the arts. And both she and my father were always very encouraging of our desire. We started doing plays when we were young. You know, we did community theater, school plays. You know, my brother and I started the drama club when we were in high school. When I was 12, I started my own theater company with all the neighborhood kids, and we performed, you know, outside and sold lemonade and, you know, 10 cents admission, making up skits and singing and dancing. And I was definitely somebody who was bitten by the bug at a very early age. And we had parents that didn't try to talk us out of that. So I'm forever grateful, because I have so many friends whose parents maybe didn't think that that was a viable option. You know, to make a living doing that. But my parents never doubted it. So that was always good to have that, because you need to have as much support as you can in this tricky business.
Understand you're a classic film buff. So I want to know a list of some of your favorite films so I can make sure I've seen them all.
I mean, I wouldn't say I'm a classic film buff. I'm not sure where that came from. But I do, you know, we do have the Criterion Collection. If you don't have that, it's okay. Such a great thing to get, because you can look at all these old films, you know, Fellini, you can look at, you know, Wertmuller, you can look at, obviously, you know, Hitchcock, but you can also look at, you know, movies, Cassavetes, things from the, you know, the era of the beginning of independent films in like the 70s and 80s that, you know, really sort of informed where we are today with independent film. And I'm also a director, and I've directed a lot of independent film and have moved into episodic directing for television because I love bringing the spirit of independent film to the high pressure cooker that is episodic directing. And I feel like I'm influenced by the work that, you know, I do when I have to create everything soup to nuts on my own.
And, you know, I enjoy your little appearances, kind of cameos in films. The Holdover, I said, hey, that's Carrie.
Yeah. Yeah, that was such a wonderful experience because obviously, speaking of great independent film directors, Alexander Payne is, you know, I think among our top five finest, you know, directors mm-hmm. working today in any medium, but especially in, you know, independent film. He's a master storyteller and one of the kindest people that you could ever work with. And so, you know, as actors, I couldn't name somebody that wouldn't want to be in an Alexander Payne movie. And so the fact that, you know, I auditioned for this role and he wanted me to be the one to play it was such a, you know, confidence booster and compliment. And, you know, working with Paul Giamatti is mm-hmm. again, like he's such a master. He's one of the best actors I've ever worked with, in any medium. And he, is so lovely. And we had just a great little turn on that. And, you know, you go in and you do these things and you don't know how they're going to cut together. I don't mm-hmm. know, but I would get these texts from Alexander as he was editing going, you're great in the film. You're great in the film. And I was like, wow, I just can't imagine that. Cause it was such a, like a small little mm-hmm. role. But then when I saw it all cut together, it was such a surprise. And it was even more of a surprise, I think, for all of us at how well that movie did and how many, many people have found it and taken such delight in it. It really, again, feels like something from another era. Like, and that was by design. Mm-hmm. Alexander really wanted it to feel like one of those great classic 1970s movies. Right. And it does.
I know it's one of those movies you can watch again and pick up certain aspects of it. It's a great movie. Well, Carrie Preston, starring in the leading role of Elsbeth Tasconi in the second season of Elsbeth on CBS. And Carrie, thanks for being my guest on 2 Main Street. And hopefully we can talk again when season 3 starts.
From your mouth to God's ears. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Carrie.
Okay.
Coming up, my interview earlier this year with another University of Evansville theater graduate, Matt Williams, actor, director, and producer of hit TV shows and movies. His new book is Glimpses. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. We'll be right back. My guest is renowned TV and movie icon Matt Williams, best known for the hit shows Roseanne and Home Improvement, and movies including Where the Heart Is and What Women Want. Matt has returned to his hometown of Evansville to launch his new book, Glimpses, a comedy writer's take on life, love, and all that spiritual stuff. It's his personal journey of family, faith, and forgiveness. Glimpses takes us to the sunny side of the street, but not before stumbling in the shadows. Growing up in a dysfunctional family, finding love the third time around, and going through therapy to deal with the two pistons powering his life, crippling insecurity and driving ambition. So Matt, welcome back to 2 Main Street. You didn't lead during that introduction, did you?
No. Who's this messed up guy you're interviewing?
But you look so normal. Okay, it turned out well. Well, now here's my quick review of your new book, Glimpses. A blue-collar kid from Indiana wins the day, healing old wounds, recalling a rags-to-riches career, and reminding us that family, friends, and forgiveness create one hell of a life journey. But we have a better review, I think, from this gentleman. To call these beautifully written pieces essays is far too limiting. These are must-read, real-life experiences that will lift your heart, restore your spirits, and nourish your soul with joy. A captivating celebration of goodness, David McFasden.
I've heard of him.
Yeah. Tell us about David McFasden, if people don't know.
Oh, he was my roommate at U of E. And he started writing plays while he was at U of E. And then we both went our separate ways. I went to New Orleans to graduate school, moved to New York. He did children's programming, et cetera. And then when I launched Roseanne, when I created Roseanne, the very first writer I hired was David. Mm-hmm. And I called him. He was teaching high school in Northern Illinois at mm-hmm. a little school there. And people said, why in the world are you hiring someone that's never written TV? And I said, that's why I'm hiring him. He's a good playwright. I know, and he's had good training from U of E. I knew his sensibility, and I also knew, quite honestly, that he would protect my flank, that I'd have a friend in the trenches with me who thought like I did. So, and then we went on and formed When Dancer Together and created Home Improvement and all these movies. So,
now, at the height of your success in showbiz, you decide on a simpler life and write for yourself and not for others. Is that the genesis of Glimpses?
Yeah, I said this previously to someone. Any time I created something that was inspired by love and guided by spirit, it succeeded. If it was inspired by competition and driven by ego, it failed. And I found I was continually turning out product instead of creating pieces from my heart. And I thought, why am I doing this? Is it because at the time I was 65, 66. I thought, am I doing this to prove I still have juice? Am I proving something to myself? Why am I? And I thought, yeah, why are you doing it? So there was a turning point that I write about in the book where one day I went, I'm done. I'm going to close up shop. I'm going to go back to our farm. And I don't know what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to allow time and spirit and just quiet to guide me. Mm-hmm. And what came out of it was these stories started unfolding. And I just, instead of judging it, I started following it. I allowed these stories to pour out. And then after a while, I went, this may be a book. Mm-hmm. So I sent these pieces to friends and fellow writers, David McFadden being one, Jim Manos, others. And I said, am I crazy? Is there something here? And they said, no, this has a pulse. You should keep writing. Mm-hmm. Jeff Sparks, who was my other roommate at U of E, he read some early on, and he encouraged me. So that's how this evolved. And now once I did that, once I created in this beautiful vacuum, this quiet vacuum, I thought, why would I go back to Hollywood and get notes from the studio, the network, the actors, the direct, and just being noted to death, to have the freedom to create whatever is floating around in your soul, whatever bubbling up from your unconscious mind. That's a gift.
Mm-hmm. Do you still need therapy?
No, this book was therapy.
Really? Okay.
No, I don't. I did. I was really screwed up. I went through to psychotherapy for 32 years. And kind of, as the metaphor I use is untangling all that, those knots, all that twisted up knots inside my brain and going, okay, why am I like this? Why am I like this? And at the end of it, I kind of went, okay, I feel pretty good now. I kind of like me. Mm-hmm. I kind of like me. It took a long time for me to like me.
And when you exited that show business madness, that helped?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because what happens is, I refer to it as mogulitis, a mogul, and you get this disease called mogulitis, where one number one show's not enough. Two, what if we get four shows on the top? Oh, our last movie wasn't in the top 10. We need to produce two more movies. And you're pushing, pushing, pushing. And you go, why am I doing this? Mm-hmm. Which comes back to, is what I'm creating of service to others? Mm-hmm. And sometimes just making them laugh may be the service. A good belly laugh and having a million people laugh at the same time at your show, that's being of service. But at the front of this book, there's the three words, love, create, serve. And I truly believe that's why we're on this earth, to love, to create. Whatever it is we create, radio programs or chocolate cakes or books, but how does what we create serve others? And that was just a deep examination saying, okay, this isn't just look at me, look what I made. How can I give back? And as I don't know if you're going to mention it, but all the profits of this book will go to charities to help children in need.
We're going to mention that.
Yep.
Now, reading the book, there's a lot of humor in the book and some dark parts of the book too. Now, your parents are, of course, are unforgettable characters in Glimpses, Frederick Golden Williams and Lily Bell. Let's start with Frederick Golden Williams.
Yeah, my mother and father they were the most unique couple on earth in many ways.
That's an understatement.
Yeah, they really were. And I couldn't put all of it in the book. That may be another book. They both graduated from Central High School here in Evansville. They did what you did in 1950, a year after graduating. They got married, and in 51, I was born. My dad worked at Whirlpool on the assembly line, but he was an amateur artist. My mother, who was always an A-B student, really smart, gave that up to become what you became at that time.
A housewife.
A housewife, stay-at-home mom. And I don't think, and they had four children. I don't think my father ever really wanted to be married, but he always wanted to have children. So it was my 15th year. I was 15 turning 16 when the family blew apart. And my mom took a job outside the house, met a man, fell in love, and ran off and abandoned us. And my father, and she got the house and all the money. And my father fought and gave her everything in order to keep the four kids together. He said, you can have everything. I have to have the four kids with me, because he came from a broken home. He had nowhere to live. We had nowhere to live. So we moved in with Wayne, my dad's friend. Dad and Wayne had a relationship for 53 years. And the word gay or queer or homosexual was never mentioned until my father turned 87. And at 87, my father finally came out. And we had this long conversation over the phone. And he said, someone said I was a homosexual. I hope you don't think that's true. And I said, Dad, hypothetically, what if it were true? Mm-hmm. I said, it wouldn't make any difference to me. Mm-hmm. I said, I love you. You were a great dad. You still are. And I will always love you. And about 24 hours later, about a day later, he called me back and he says, Wayne and I have had a relationship. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, no kidding, after 53 years living together?
This just in.
And then, so that was my dad. And my mom married six times. She was in a race with Elizabeth Taylor. Elizabeth Taylor and my mom were born in the same year. But my mom didn't match her for husbands because Elizabeth married Richard Burton twice.
Okay.
She was married seven times. My mom was only married six times. But she was going to remarry one of her husbands, but he died before they could get married again. If she had done that, she would have tied Elizabeth Taylor. Mm-hmm. And my mom, who was wacky and crazy and fun. I always said, when my father told you a story, you cried. When my mother told you a story, you laughed.
Yeah.
But with my mom, when she turned 60, I was on Home Improvement. It was the number one show on TV. And she called me, and she was between husbands. And I said, Mom, happy birthday. You're 60 years old. Just think about this. And I said, is there anything you regret? And she said, going to college. She said, I always made good grades. I love school. I said, Mom, pick any college you want. I'll pay for it. Go anywhere in the world. I'll pay for it. And about a week later, she calls back. She said, I found where I want to go. I want to go to Oral Roberts University in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And to her credit, David, and that's in the book, she went to Oral Roberts University and in 4 years got her undergraduate degree and a Master's of Divinity.
Gosh.
And was on the dean's list. So my mother, who's 62, 63 at the time, is sending me her report card. And I'm calling her going, Mom, you got, look, 3 A's and 2 B's. This is great.
And she had a pretty good vocabulary, didn't she?
Oh, yes, she did.
Because I know when you lived on Reed Street.
Yes, yes.
She would comment on the folks next door.
Yes. When we lived in a little house on Reed Street, and at the time, next door was a tavern, a neighborhood tavern. And, you know, where guys and gals, after they got off work, would go and have a drink. But on Saturday night, they would have a live band. Where our house was only about 8 feet from the wall of the tavern. And they had a live band with a drummer and an electric guitar.
It was like a shotgun?
Yeah, it was Shotgun House.
Shotgun House, okay.
Right next to the tavern.
Oh, boy.
And so on Saturday night, I'd be lying there in bed, and the bed would be vibrating with rock music coming from the tavern next door. And my mother, we went to church every single Sunday, no matter what. And I've told this story before, but I remember she'd go to bed with her hair in curlers and put Vicks salve under her nose so she could breathe. And one Saturday night, she jumped out of there, I guess it was around 12:30 at night, 1 o'clock, and ran next door and kicked the door open with a bar full of people. They stopped playing the rock and roll music. And she says, if you don't stop beating that drum, I'm going to shove those sticks so far up your ass. And the whole place cheered and broke out in applause. And she told them all to kiss her ass and walk back home. Kiss her ass because I have to go to church in the morning.
That's good. That's good. That's that last line. There you go. Now, the book is dedicated to Angelina, your wife.
My wife. God bless her. Yes.
Yes. And how did you guys meet?
We met in New York City when I was teaching myself how to be a playwright. I started writing some one-acts. And I said, if I'm seriously going to pursue being a professional writer, I need to learn my craft. But I can't take 3 years writing another play. So I started writing one-act plays, and they were exercises to me, and they were all funny. And I wrote them, and I shoved them in a drawer. And Angelina's good friend, Suzanne Brinkley, who was a director, had been to the American College Theater Festival and saw the production that John David Lutz directed.
Okay.
And she came to New York and cold called me, out of the blue, just called me. She goes, where's your other plays? And I said, I don't have any. And she says, no, you have plays. Where are they? And I said, they're in a drawer. I've got them locked away. They're not very good. She said, I want to read them. She read them. She said, these are really good. I want to produce them and direct them. And she did. And one of the plays won a festival, a contest. While she was producing and directing those plays, her friend, Angelina Fiordalisi, came off tour of Annie and was between shows and came to New York. And she came down and helped us produce those plays. And I write about it in the book. They can read about it, but it was one of those moments where Suzanne took me back to the apartment she was sharing with Angelina. This is the God's truth, David. I walked in. Angelina was on her hands and knees doing spring cleaning. She was scrubbing a toilet. She swears it was the bathtub, but it was the toilet. And she had on those yellow gloves with Lysol spray. And I walked in, I looked at her, and she looked up at me. And spirit, the spirit voice that I write about a lot in the book, I took one look and I went, I'm going to marry this woman and have children with her.
Six children.
I turned when I walked out. I turned to Suzanne and made a joke. I said, I'm going to marry Angelina Fiordalisi, have six children, and move to New Jersey. And this went on and went on and on and became a joke. And finally, Suzanne just snapped it. She says, don't tease about this stuff. She takes it seriously. So we had two kids and moved to Los Angeles.
My guest is Matt Williams, Mark Williams, to his classmates at Wrights High School and the University of Evansville. His new book is Glimpses, A Personal Journey to Find Light in the Shadows and His Relationship with God. So how do you define God?
Well,
and you call God a she in the book.
I do, because, look, we tend to create God in our image, right? The God I grew up with in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in Evansville, Indiana, was this angry, bearded, white guy sitting on a cloud waiting for me to step out of line and throw me into hell, right? That was the God. You had to fear God. Mm-hmm. And as I got older, I go, really? Is that what I want to spend all my time appeasing this petulant parent, you know, this police officer? Mm-hmm. That's how I'm going to tiptoe through life, but hoping God doesn't throw me into hell? And I thought, that doesn't make sense. So I started looking at other religions. I am not a theologian. I am not a scholar. But I started reading Buddhist beliefs, Islam, started looking at these other religions and going, wow, once you strip away the patriarchal, hierarchical structure of most of these organizations and get down to the simple message, it is very simple. Love God and love your neighbor as yourself. Just be kind, be gentle, be compassionate, take care of the poor. Mm-hmm. Right. And so then as I got into college and out into New York, I went, how can we slap a sex on God? There's the famous book, When God Was a Woman. So I started looking at the early Christian mystics who often referred to God in the feminine. And one of my favorite quotes is from Meister Eckhart, the Christian mystic, who says, what does God do all day? He lies on a maternity bed giving birth to universes. And so I won't go off in the weeds on this. When Constantine and the Roman Empire and all this, and it became very male and no women, and we're excluding the feminine, we only have the masculine, it's male, onward Christian soldiers. I went, mm-hmm. That song is kind of repulsive because it's the opposite to the teachings of Christ. Mm-hmm. You're not a soldier. He was railing against soldiers. He was railing against the oppressor. So then as I evolved, I thought, how can God ever be defined as male or female? And if he is male, which most religions want to make him, what color is God's skin? And James McBride, one of my favorite authors, has a book called The Color of Water, because he was from an interracial family. Mother was Jewish, father was African-American. And one day he asked his mother, said, what color is God's skin? And she said, it's the color of water. And I thought, that's pretty brilliant.
That is good.
I'll say one last thing, and then I'll get off my little soapbox here I'm standing on.
Or your pulpit.
My pulpit.
Yeah.
What really started turning things around for me when I stopped thinking of God as a noun and started thinking of God as a verb, as the divine creative force that has created and animated all life throughout the universe. And we live in an expanding universe, mm-hmm. right? It keeps evolving. And what is that life force? What is that force that expands the universe? What is the same infinite intelligence that lives in a whale that swims 2,000 miles to the same water to give birth and 2,000 miles back? The same intelligence, if you look at a robin's nest, every single robin's nest is uniform. I started to write an essay going, do they go to the grandma robins and they all teach them how to build nests? But no, there is some kind of intelligence that guides that. Mm-hmm. What is that intelligence?
Right.
I don't know who, I can't even begin to define God, because if we could comprehend God, God would stop being God. Hmm.
Did you consult with anyone in the clergy in writing this book?
No. I did send it to a number of friends who are of different faiths. Mm-hmm. And I said, I am not here to proselytize. I am not here to convince or convert anyone. The lens through which I tell these stories is a Christian lens, because that's how I was raised.
Right.
I shun the Christian label, because in today's political world and divisive world, that takes on a whole different connotation. So I find it easier to say I'm a follower of Christ. Mm-hmm. And that's what I am. I follow Christ's teachings.
Okay. Now, there's a cliche of having an angel on one shoulder and a devil on the other. Have you experienced that through your career?
Oh, yeah. But the devil was usually me.
Okay.
The devil was my roaring ambition.
Okay.
And
one of those pistons, yeah.
One of those pistons, because crippling insecurity, and I think any true artist, every artist I've ever met of any value whatsoever, is plagued with doubt. Doubt is, especially a writer, doubt is a writer's constant companion. So you have to flick that little doubt demon off your shoulder and just keep going, right? Mm-hmm. Questioning, you're not smart enough, you're not good enough. Now, therapy helps, but also mm-hmm. I think that insecurity drives you, but the demon was ambition, which is competing and comparing. If you really want to be unhappy in life, compete with others and compare your life to theirs.
Okay.
And in Hollywood, that's all you do.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, you need those things for success, but you have to balance it, right?
The balance for me was Angelina and my family.
Okay.
I didn't get caught up. I didn't run around to parties. I didn't go to Vegas on the weekend. I worked very hard, 6, oftentimes 7 days a week. And when I wasn't working, I went home to my wife and our 2 little kids. And she and the family was the ballast that kept the boat from tipping over.
Okay.
And I think also because success for me, yes, the Cosby Show, I was in my early 30s, but when I really hit, I was in my late 30s. I didn't become a parent till I was 37 and 39. So my real success hit in my late 30s, early 40s. So I was a little more mature. Mm-hmm. I had been through two divorces. I had been knocked around in the industry. So when it came, I went, this is great. This is nice having a couple number one shows. But this is not who I am. Mm-hmm. That in my essence, that's not who I am.
Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. If you are just joining us, my guest is Evansville native Matt Williams, creator of hit TV shows Roseanne and Home Improvement, with several movies to his credit, including What Women Want and Wild Hearts Can't Be Broken. Matt's visiting from his farm in the Hudson Valley to launch his new book, Glimpses, a comedy writer's take on life, love, and all that spiritual stuff. A theme of forgiveness, we mentioned Momo. You did also reconcile with your mom and dad in their final days.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there nothing got unsaid at the end, and mm-hmm. everything was resolved, and there was deep love, and especially with my mother, because when the family blew apart, there were years where I was busy, she was off marrying different men, and we didn't even talk for years. But toward the end, she was as raw and pure and sweet as she could be. And everything was resolved. So when both of them passed, I had complete peace in my heart. Whatever trauma we went through in our teen years and the 20s and all that, my teen and 20 years, was resolved.
And they're both buried here in Evansville?
Yes. Okay. My father actually was cremated, so some of his ashes are here. The rest are up on the farm.
Okay. All right. Okay. And we have some, I want to mention this. You write in the book that you did find God in the form of Ed Asner.
Well, the God that I described earlier in the program, that mean guy up on a cloud waiting to throw you into hell.
Kind of the curmudgeon God.
Curmudgeon, that angry guy. then when I worked with Ed Asner, he was an imp. He was just delightful. And I tell this story. He just had a way of deflating ego and just leveling everyone to a wonderfully, mm-hmm. wonderfully same to the a wonderful same place, right? Oh. So I'm there giving notes to the director, and I've got my script, and I'm the showrunner, I'm the boss, and I'm doing this, and I'm doing this, and I feel someone pinch my butt, and I jump and I turn, and it's Ed Asner, and he looks at me and he winks, and I went, and he walked away, and that was his way of saying, don't get so full of yourself. We're having fun here.
Okay.
And I said, boy, I wish God would pinch my butt and wink at me occasionally instead of throwing thunderbolts at me.
Some early reviews. Matt has done something extraordinary in this book. He has revealed his own flawed humanity so that we may see ourselves more honestly and more hopefully. I finished Glimpses inspired to notice more, savor more, and most importantly, love more. Not many books do that. Father Edward Beck. Who is Father Edward Beck?
He is a playwright and author, and he is a CNN commentator. Anytime there's any kind of news breaks with the Vatican or the Catholic Church, he's usually the one called. And he has come to several of my readings, and he has been very supportive and very gracious. And I like what he said, because one of the things I tried to do, David, in this book was to be as authentic and honest as I could be about who I am and my journey, as opposed to constantly presenting the persona of Matt Williams. And that's why this book was really written by Mark Williams.
You also write in the book that kindness is contagious. And I guess you've witnessed that.
Yeah, I really do. The Bible says the measure you give is the measure you get back. I really believe that. And do unto others, you have them do unto you. And if you're kind, I may be kind to you, and it may not be reciprocated mm-hmm. by you.
Right.
But somewhere, maybe it's the person standing in line at the grocery store. So kindness does ripple out. There is my deepest hope for this book is that it encourages compassion, celebrates kindness, and inspires hope. That's what I want this book to do.
I'm sure some stories didn't make the book, and I talked earlier about your football career at Rice High School.
Yeah, there's quite a few. I didn't realize how many I had written. And when Adriana Trigiani, my dear friend and best-selling author, read an early draft, she goes, "This is pretty long, Matt." And I went, "Okay, I can toss that one out. I'll toss this one out." But one of the essays that didn't make it into the book was called Fundamentals. And Herman Byers, who was the winningest football coach in Indiana history, was my football coach my last year in high school and his last year coaching. And what he always did at the beginning of every season was, whether you played all 4 years or you were a freshman, you began with fundamentals. You had to have, and I wrote an essay about, as parents, what are the fundamentals we are teaching our children? What fundamentals are we giving our children? And so it goes on from there. That one didn't make the book.
Okay. So what is next for the creative mind of Matt Williams?
I'm working on and have been working on a musical for several years called Delta Blue. It's a blues gospel musical. I just spent a week at Goodspeed Opera House with part of the team there reworking the book. And we've got the book written. We've got all the songs written that we are refining. This has been a long process, and it's going to be an even longer process. So that's my only non-book project, okay? Mm-hmm. And as I finished this, I said, I felt these other, I've got like two books competing, mm-hmm. and I don't know which one's going to win. But every morning I wake up, and one of them's over here going, "Hey, me, choose me." And this one's going, "Choose me." But I can't wait after I finish this book signing. I'm going to go back and pull out the yellow pad and start scribbling. So.
Well, Matt Williams, Mark Williams, congratulations on the book, Glimpses, which does take us to the sunny side of the street, and also sharing your personal journey of family, faith, and forgiveness. Thanks again.
Oh, thank you so much.
Been a lot of fun. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. 2 Main Street airs Thursday at noon and Saturday at 11. Previous shows are online at WNIN.org.